What I'd like to do is go through those verses in the last section again, reading just a little bit of the purports and going through it from the point of view that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur makes in one of the purports there. This purport to text 40. He says, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has pointed out that in verses 35 to 39, five verses, the various stages of standard logic are demonstrated. Verse 35 establishes visha, or the general thesis. Verse 36 manifests samshaya, or an expression of doubt. 37 gives the purvapaksha, or the opposing argument. Verse 38 definitely establishes siddhanta, or conclusion. And verse 39 presents sangati, the summary. The sangati, or final word, is that one should become a pure devotee of the personality of Godhead and worship the Lord's lotus feet, and then thus be able to see, when one's consciousness is cleansed, one won't be able to see him and all his paraphernalia very clearly. So we'll just go through it, the verses, from that perspective, which is different from the previous perspective. So in 35, which is the general thesis, or the point that's being made, and that is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan, is the cause of creation, maintenance, and destruction of this universe. Yet he has no prior cause. There's no cause earlier than him, or before him. He's the cause of all causes. Mata parataram nanyat kinchid asti aham savasya prabhavo. So he's the primal cause, Adi Govinda, Ishwara Paramakrishna, Savakarna Karnam. He pervades the various states of wakefulness, dreaming, and unconscious deep sleep. So his consciousness, his potencies are that which we rest upon. And he also exists beyond them. So although his potencies are giving us life, he is beyond those potencies. He has another existence as well. By entering the body of every living entity, being as the supersoul, he enlivens the body, senses, life airs, and mental activities. And thus, all the subtle and gross organs of the body begin their functions. My dear King, know that Supreme Personality of Godhead to be the Supreme. He is the Param. He gives life. He is the one who upon whom we are resting. Because we're not resting on our own potencies, because then things wouldn't happen that we don't want. So we're resting on something greater and more powerful than us. And it's not just the material energy, as the materialistic scientists are saying, because we don't see any where in existence where life comes from matter. We see rather that matter comes from life. So rather we are resting upon the potencies of the Supreme Lord. That's the premise. That he is Lord Narayan. He exists as Lord Narayan through his energies. He exists as, he is also his expansion, the Purusha. And then also, as we shall hear, he's also Brahman. Those three are all his aspects. And we already heard that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's comment that Brahman is the effulgence, concentrated effulgence of the Supreme Lord, and he's quoted from Harivansh on that. So that's the premise. And then a doubt is expressed. This is how often tikkas or commentaries are written. There's a doubt, then the opposing argument, and then the conclusion. So the doubt is expressed in 36. Neither the mind nor the faculties of speech, sight, intelligence, the life air, or any of the senses which you just described has been activated by the Supreme Personality of Godhead are capable of penetrating that Supreme Truth. any more than small sparks can affect the original fire from which they are generated. So, in other words, you're making a statement about the Supreme Lord, but actually he's ununderstandable. You can't make a positive statement about him because you can't make it by virtue of your intelligence, and then he continues, because that is just like the sparks can't define the fire because they are generated from the fire. So similarly, we are generated from that Supreme. So how can we make any statement about him? So I doubt your statement. Not even the authoritative language of the Vedas can perfectly describe the Supreme Truth, since the Vedas themselves disclaim the possibility that the truth can be expressed in words. So he's saying that the conclusion that you've reached, I doubt that it's true, because there's no Vedic reference for it directly, because that absolute truth cannot be defined, expressed by words. But through indirect reference, the Vedic sounds does serve as evidence of the Supreme Truth, since without the existence of the Supreme Truth, the various restrictions found in the Vedas would have no ultimate purpose, because the ultimate purpose of the Vedas is to realize the Supreme Truth, and if there was no Supreme Truth, then there would be no purpose to the Vedas, and therefore the Vedas shouldn't exist, and since they do exist and they do have a purpose, therefore the Absolute Truth must exist, but we can't really say anything about it. It's inexpressible, and we can only say Vyatarek definitions of it. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. So that's the doubt expressed according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And then what the Purvapaksha, or the opposing statement, the statement that opposes the thesis proposed that the Supreme Lord was the Purusha and Lord Narayan, and now there was a doubt expressed, and now an opposing statement is being made. Originally one, so this is the conclusion that of the Purvapaksha, the opposing thesis, antithesis. Originally one, the Absolute Brahman comes to be known as threefold. So it's actually formless, but it becomes to be known as threefold, manifesting itself in the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. Brahman further expands its potencies, and thus the power to act and the power of consciousness becomes manifest, along with the false ego. So in other words, the whole material creation is really only Brahman, but it's known as something other than Brahman. It's known as something other than this great oneness. Thus, by the expansion of the multipotencies of the Absolute, the demigods, everything comes from this. The embodiment of knowledge become manifest along with the material senses, their objects, and the results of material activities, happiness and distress. So all this illusory stuff is just really only this oneness, this Brahman. This is the Purvapaksha statement. In this way, the manifestation of the material world takes place as a subtle cause, and the material effect visible in the appearance of gross material objects. Brahman, which is the source of all subtle and gross manifestations, is simultaneously transcendental to them, being absolute. It's beyond. It's everything. It's the great oneness. So now, here is the Siddhanta, or the conclusion, reestablishing the original thesis about the Supreme Lord, and he's giving life to the living entities. He's giving it, the ability for the living entities. They're resting upon him. So he says in 38, Brahman, the eternal soul, so this is this Brahman, that the soul is eternal, and it's also Brahman, was never born, it never came into being, and it will never die, nor does it grow or decay. That spirit soul is actually the knower of youth, middle age, and death of the material body. So here is the Vaishnava conclusion. Thus the soul can be understood to be pure consciousness, as it existing everywhere at all times and never being destroyed. Just as the life air within the body, although one, becomes manifest as many in contact with the various material senses, the one soul appears to assume various material designations in contact with the material body. So there's one soul, and then he appears one time to be a human being, and then he appears to be a demigod, and then he appears to be an animal, and he appears to be an insect, and he appears to be a fish, and he appears to be a bird. But it's actually just one soul. And he doesn't come into existence at some point. He's aham brahmasmi. I am Brahman, that one soul is eternal spiritual existence. And then in 39, so that's the, and it's resting, as was previously said, on the, his abilities are resting on the super soul. And in 39, this is a conclusion, the summary of the conclusion, the sanghiti. The spirit soul is born in many different species of life within the material world. So very similar to the previous verse. Some species are born from eggs, some from embryos, others from the seeds of plants and trees, others from perspiration. But in all species of life, the prana, or vital air, remains unchanging and follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Similarly, the spirit soul is eternally the same despite its material conditions of life. So the as the prana doesn't change, the soul doesn't change. And we have practical experience that the soul exists eternally. And even when it doesn't perceive its own existence, like when it's in deep sleep, or it may not perceive its existence in Brahman, but actually it does have individual existence. So when we're absorbed in deep sleep without dreaming, the material senses become inactive, and even the mind and false ego emerge into dormant condition. But although the senses, mind, and false ego are inactive, one remembers. So that means there's a continuity of identity, because one remembers that one had a good sleep. That means it was that soul, that person who had a good sleep. He didn't actually lose his existence, although he was unaware of it. So he remembers that he, the soul, was peacefully sleeping. And then how can one... So that's the end of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's comment. And then the same point, how does one actually become realized if one wants Brahman, or one wants to understand the Purusha, or one wants to understand Bhagavan? One has to take to devotional service, and then one's consciousness becomes purified, and one's heart becomes cleansed, and then one can actually see accurately instead of seeing in an illusory way. So just a few, read a few comments, and then we shall open up for questions. Just a few. You know, one comment, how to understand the Supreme Lord. As stated in the Padma Purana, Ataksi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Ghayam Indriyai Sevan Mukhi Hijivadal Sayam Eva Sparat Yada. Material senses cannot appreciate Krishna's holy name, form, qualities, and pastimes. But when a conditioned soul is awakened to Krishna consciousness and renders service by using his tongue to chant the Lord's holy name and taste the remnants of the Lord's food, the tongue is purified, and one gradually comes to understand who Krishna really is. If one surrenders, end of quote, if one surrenders to the Supreme Lord, taking shelter of his lotus feet, one's spiritualized senses gradually become empowered to perceive the Lord. Mere empiricism and material logic have a limited jurisdiction within the external energy of the Supreme Lord, and they cannot apply to those things which are eternal. Quotation I'm looking for. This is on to text 38. This is from the purport to the end, before the leads up to the end. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has further pointed out that instead of wasting time trying to understand the truth in its impersonal aspect, which is merely the negation of temporary material variety, one should try to understand oneself to be an eternally conscious entity in the jiva category. In other words, one should understand oneself to be eternally a conscious servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this regard, Srimad Vacharya has quoted the following statement from the Moksha Dharma section of the Mahabharata. And there's Sanskrit, six lines of Sanskrit verses. The living entity known as jiva is not different from me, for he is my expansion. Thus the living entity is eternal as I am and always exists with me. But you should not artificially think, now I have seen the soul. Rather, I, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will bestow this benediction upon you when you're actually qualified. So it is in spiritual life. When we're actually qualified, Krishna will benedict us with all the vision. But we should not try to just simply understand ourselves as soul. We should understand ourselves as soul in relationship to the Absolute Truth, to Krishna as his servant. Okay, we'll stop here. And now we have time for any questions or comments. Comments as well. So that last section was very technical. Yes? Was it technical? It was quite technical. Questions or comments on anything that we read or spoke about today?
Disposal of Visaya, Samsaya, Purvapaksha, the Siddhanta, those approaches of the impersonalists who are discussing and try to come to knowledge, understanding the knowledge. My question is, why is Srila Bhaktivedanta Saraswati analyzing these persons through that perspective?
But it's not, if it's a process of nyaya, of logic, so deductive logic. So when it's used to, on in and of itself, to find the absolute truth, then it certainly comes out with impersonalism or something like that. But so Pipalayana is speaking here, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is just analyzing the way his presentation from the point of view of nyaya. But nyaya itself ultimately is neutral. It's not impersonalistic. We use logic all the time. It's one of the pramanas, but it should be used in the anuman, or inference. It should be used in the service of shastra, to prove the points of shastra. I'm not sure if that quite answered what you were asking.
Yeah. So before Vedanta is built like this.
Yeah. And the acharyas, this is how they comment in Vedanta. They have, this is the traditional way of commenting. You give a doubt, here's the thesis that's been given, then you give a doubt, then you give an opposing opinion, and then you overthrow the opposing opinion. But Baladev uses this system too in his commentary of Vedanta. It's traditional. So when you're dealing, if you want to be accepted by the traditional schools and to establish Gaudiya Vaishnavism, as Baladev did, he used the traditional methodology. Did you ever look and see how he dealt with Vedanta? Probably just because he wrote some verses and a little bit on commentary on Vedanta, I think.
But there is a similar Panchanga Nyaya he mentions in the Adi Lila, I think it's 7104, where if you look Hetu Pratigya, it's like a parallel name, which also has five steps, similar five steps, just different terminology. The Prabhupada says this is how it sounds.
So these are five steps. But I remember when I studied the methodology, there are 17, 18 steps, and I don't remember all.
Well, I think there's different schools of nyaya also. There's Navanyaya and Nyaya. And who was the original teacher of the methodology of nyaya? That was Gautam Rishi. Well, one way is what he did with the four Kumaras, what he did with Sukadeva Goswami. They were impersonalists, but he gave them more. But for without directly answering your question, he gives people what they want. So as you're pointing out, the problem with an impersonalist, once they get what they want, they stop to exist anymore, and they don't desire anymore. But if by association, if they're impersonalists and they're on that path, if by association they get an opportunity to hear, like the Sukadev did, like the four Kumaras did, they got a chance to associate with the Lord Himself, they changed. So it's Krishna, that's one. If he so desires, he can arrange a situation where they get better association. And then they have free will to take it or not take it. So the free will is still there. So he can adjust their path. And that's actually the path that's given in the Bhagavad Gita, the yoga ladder, the basic path from karma to jnana to yoga to full Bhagavan realization. Paramatma realization to Bhagavan realization. So through association is how that's affected. And that association, good association, is the gift of the Lord. Especially for someone who's very much on the impersonal path, they have to associate with someone very, very highly realized. So that's specifically a gift of Krishna who arranges that. Or if they study Shastra, they can understand it, read Chaitanya Charitamrita. But it's very difficult for an impersonalist. And therefore, impersonalism, we are ordered to avoid them because they're aparadis, or not impersonalists even, but mayavadis specifically. But an impersonalist, if they get good association, they'll transfer. If they're mayavadis, then big problem, because they always see that the form of Krishna and devotional service as maya, is a product of the mode of goodness. So you're right, it's problematic for them, especially if they get what they want, it's even worse. Yes.
In one of the texts, I think 33, there's a mention of sleep and dreaming. Good sleep is necessary to keep body fit, keep soul and body together, so we can do services. Yet the sleep is in mode of ignorance. Even then we sleep, I sleep for 5 to 6 hours. So how do we help this situation? It's in mode of ignorance. You can run the tape or anything, but still you sleep fast.
Yes, so what's the question?
So, is it a mode of ignorance if you sleep?
Well, you just said it was the mode of ignorance.
Yeah.
But if you're an exalted devotee, like the example of Raghunath Das Goswami and the Goswamis, that they were so intent on their service, and they were so Krishna conscious and fully involved while they were awake, that when they were slept, they dreamt about Krishna too. So they didn't go into the mode of ignorance. They kept with Krishna always. So that's ideal. But right now, for the resting of the intelligence, sleep is required. So we have to do that, and so we try to deal as little as possible and with the mode of ignorance, and therefore we're always suggested to minimize, but not so minimize to the degree that we're always tired all the time and can't do any service, but to just take as much as required. One time someone said to him, challenged him, that you have your people, your disciples not sleeping enough. And Prabhupada's reply was, what's wrong with that? Great men don't sleep a lot. And he gave the example of Napoleon and others, who I don't remember who he gave. And then another time he said, I hate sleep, because you can't, it's harder to serve. So And I also saw one time when he came to Australia, he said a reporter tried to capture Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was not capturable. He said, "You have your devotees, you have your followers sleeping 6 hours a night only, because the Western standard they hold up is 8 hours or something." So, and the mood, what he was trying to say is that you're exploiting them, trying to get them to work more. And then he said, "And how many hours a day do you sleep?" And Prabhupada said, "I go to sleep at 10 o'clock and wake up at 12 o'clock. And that's what was Prabhupada's basic schedule. And then one of the devotees didn't like the challenging mood, so he said to the reporter, "Prabhupada doesn't, he sleeps less than anyone. He sleeps only 4 hours a night." And Prabhupada said, "No, I go to sleep 10 o'clock and wake up 12 o'clock.
Where's
your position? Well, 35.
35 and
37. Yes. 35 is talking about what?
About the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
And the person.
Yeah.
Person. Yes. And 37.
Speaking of Brahman.
Okay.
But that's the effulgence of the person.
Right, but it's not talking about Brahman as the effulgence of the person. It's talking, the step prior to that was, we can't really say it's a person, either by the Vedas or through our own intelligence or anything like that, because the absolute truth is undescribable. So instead of saying that he's a person, he's undescribable, he's the entity who's everything, the oneness of everything. And from that entity of everything, basically we could say in an illusory sense, everything else has come. But it's actually everything ultimately is that Brahman. So that's 37, isn't it? That we can't say it's a person. We don't have the ability, because he's impenetrable. We cannot penetrate into the absolute truth sufficiently to say that he's a person. It's a very, like an agnostic position. But what we can say about the absolute truth is that everything, and we can realize this, that everything is the absolute truth, or the absolute truth of the oneness, soham. You follow? We say that the absolute truth, that Brahman is the effulgence of the Supreme Lord, but they don't say that. They say everything is that. Tattvamasi. This is what it is. It's just, it is. Nowadays it's very popular in contemporary circles to say, it is, you know, just be, it is now, and keep your consciousness in the space between the words. The space is where reality is, the nothingness. That's that we can understand, that's what they say. Any other questions or comments? Yes?
On that point, that when we wake up, that we remember having had a deep sleep.
Yes.
I think it's very significant, because
yes,
we are all fearful, because ultimate fear is death, then we are finished. But Srila Prabhupada makes a point, death is like deep sleep, but longer. And then one wakes up in another body. So I think that conviction that we are the soul, by that logic, it helps to understand that we are the soul.
Yeah, that there's a
very important point. Yeah. But at the same time, the point was made, Lord Narayan is in the fourth type of consciousness,
the Turiya.
The soul, to experience the soul, that experience, we are awake, but the state of being awake is a material conscious state. That it's one of the three material conscious states. But this is not an experience direct of the soul, because the soul may have that experience through the material nature, but it is brought into our consciousness by the super soul. Because because that was not a point made in the explanation today, that everything, the senses, the mind, and it's activated by the super soul. So it's a little bewildering for me that we have an experience, but this experience is not really the experience of the soul.
But what are we experiencing now?
Yeah.
It's not the real experience of the soul, and it's also given by the super soul. But it's to help us understand. It's such an interesting point. Usually, it's that point is used because that deep sleeping stage where there's no dream is comparable, not exactly the same, but is comparable to Brahman realization. And interestingly enough, when we wake up, we think, "Boy, that was really good." So that means that Brahman realization is really good. It's much better than the suffering of the material world. And that's basically more or less what it's like. There's no sense of self, there's no sense of suffering. There's existence, but you're not really conscious of yourself existing. So it's nothing that we're used to. Because you're existing, but not conscious of yourself existing. So we're used to the self-reflecting, being conscious of ourselves. So it's such a thing, and on one level we fear it, but another level when we wake up and say, that was really great. But yet, it's only really great in comparison to material existence. But compared to spiritual existence, it's compared to hell.
I remember Bhakti Vijaya Maharaj, he made a presentation at the Ramacharya seminar in Tata Bhaktivedanta Mount in Dom a few months ago. And it was about Buddhi in the devotional service, the importance of Buddhi. Because the Buddhi is like part of the mind, and it's processing information. The fact that we need sleep, he explained, is because this Buddhi needs rest, needs to be recharged.
Yes.
And then we have sleep, and we get up, and we feel refreshed, because the Buddhi has again this energy.
Yeah.
But then when the Buddhi is fed with transcendental knowledge, and we process it to transcendental knowledge, then when it's spiritualized, then that need for sleep is not so much there. Like the six Goswamis, like Srila Prabhupada was sleeping 2 hours only, because the Buddhi is spiritualized. That was more or less the essence of Maharaj's presentation.
So it's getting its energy from a different level,
yeah,
is what it sounds like he was pointing out.
I try also to understand how it fits in with this presentation.
It may not. Yeah, the soul never becomes tired.
Yeah.
But sometimes we become tired in a conventional sense, because the material energy wears you down. There's no perpetual energy-producing machine. It needs something else to feed into it. And eventually the machine of the material universe wears out, and it has to be withdrawn. I, from the Sankhya point of view, as I understand it, the subtle body in the soul goes back into Vishnu at that time. I can't remember where I read it in Prabhupada's books. And there's a state called, I think it's called Pragya or something like that. Huh? Yeah, that just means the deep sleep. but that's what's so good about it. You're getting recharged by going to the source of the energy. That's what recharging means. So, but then, see, the thing that really hit me about this, where it really glorifies bhakti, because this you can say it's so interesting, right? And you know, people who are intellectually based, they love to like dive into this stuff and just figure it out. And then soon we're going, when the topic changes to the Uddhava Gita, we're going to hear something very interesting as a preliminary verses by Uddhava. And he's talking about like these kind of people, these jnani type of people. So one, he says, naked sages like the Navayogendras, who seriously endeavor in spiritual practices, who have raised their semen upward, who are peaceful and sinless members of the renounced order, they attain the spiritual abode of Brahman. And then just before that, though, he says, but we are different. And then he says, Twai upabukta vaghanda vasa alankana charchita uchista bhoktina dasas tavamaya jayamahi. That we are very different from these kind of people. Just by taking the remnants of your food and by wearing the clothes that you have worn already, upabhukta, that you've already worn as prasadam, and by smelling the fragrance and accepting the garlands that you have worn, then tava maya, your maya, Jane, we will conquer. So we have a different process completely. But it's in the right consciousness. We, your servants, and that's the key. Uchista bhoktino bhojino dashas. If we are in the consciousness of being his servants, then by Krishna's mercy, but not only the servants in the sense of servants that we see it in the material world, where you know someone's a servant here and he's getting paid so much to be a servant, a driver, or this or that, but a loving servant, and not doing work but doing seva. Here is my offering that I want to make out of you for you for love, and I don't require anything in return. This is our nature. This is what Prahlad told Lord Nisringadev. There's no need for you to say, I'll give you a benediction. We are in our natural relationship. You're my master, and I'm your servant. So I don't need anything from you. So when we're in that mood, and with great devotion, as Mahaprabhu taught us, to honor the flower garlands of the Lord, and to accept prasad seva. I remember I went one time, quite a few years ago, 96 it was, I think, I went to the place of this Prem Tali in Bangladesh, where Narottama Das, near Khetri, where Narottama Das, it was said, went into the Padma River, and he was infused with the love of God, that the Prema Bhakti that Mahaprabhu had left there for him. And then he went out and sat under a particular tree that's called Prem Tali. So there's, now it's built up, I've heard, but then it was quite simple. It was just a compound in Muslim Bangladesh, mm-hmm. in near Raj Sahi, I think, if I remember correctly. But and then we just got off, myself and Jagtuni Mataji, just, there was a compound, and we sort of knocked on the door, and there was one old lady, elderly Mataji, who was taking care of it. Her husband wasn't there, her son wasn't there right then, and she was a widow, and she came, and she couldn't speak any English, and we couldn't speak any Bengali, really, and we got a glimpse of what Vaishnava hospitality is, Atithi Bhagawan. So she just immediately brought us in, and then the whole place was covered in cow dung, and the houses, you know, the little houses, simple houses there, right by the river. And then she said, prasad seva. We'll get a chance to offer you prasadam so you can honor it and serve it. How do we serve it? We serve it by eating it. The remnants of the Lord, utista, that which has been enjoyed by the Lord, upabozena, after you've enjoyed it, I want to take that. And then, you know, so we got in touch with actually what the culture is. We eat our prasadam. Properly we should honor it, not say any amrita power, not cow eating, but we honor the prasadam. And then right after it was so sweet. After she cooked for us, and then after we finished, instead of like washing the area, just took some cow dung, more cow dung, and just went right over it, and it dried. It was just so, it was so wonderful. Just to be in touch with that. And then every night, some of the villagers, Hindu villagers, would come on Kirtan, and they'd go to different places for the, it might have been, I don't remember, but they had taken a vow for a month every night, some of the young boys, to do Kirtan every night and visit a few places. It was like a different universe. But just the point of actually seva, when we read in Chaitanya Charitamrita near the end, when Mahaprabhu was given the prasad of Lord Jagannath, he's saying these are ordinary ingredients that you see everywhere, and we've seen them before, we've smelled them before, but this is completely different. What we have in our hand, because Lord Jagannath has tasted them, and then he went into ecstasy. So the process of bhakti is different. It's devotion, devotional service. So we can use all this, trying to understand it all, and we're given the Bhagavatam, so of course we must do that, and this is why we've been given type of intelligence, so we use it, and that was one of the points there, that everything should be used. Whatever we've been given, whatever situation we find ourselves in, we should use it with devotion to please Krishna. So if due to our fate we have some intelligence, we should use it. But yet our process isn't an ascending process, the process of just understanding. Because the understanding, as we heard the Madhvacharya's quote, the understanding is a gift. You'll understand that you're a soul, not by the process of neti-neti and of deep discrimination that the jnanis use, but by the process of... Do you remember that quotation I read? It was so sweet, actually, that by my grace, when you're qualified, then I will give you the benediction, and then you will understand. And usually, being what we are or what I am, we want to, break open the doors and, bust in there. And here I am, Krishna. Here I am. Welcome to Goloka Vrindavan. No one's here to welcome me. What's the problem? Gop Kumar got a big hug and all the ornaments. No one's here. So we should do our part, which is the qualification, which is mainly the sincerity and the increasing of the desires. And we should be respectful of what it really is. And it's not this projection of my material mind. It's not like that. It's like when Prabhupada was asked in 1967 during the Vietnam War in the United States, and during the Vietnamese war days in 1967, the young men were being drafted into the army, and everyone was afraid of that. All the young men were afraid of that. And so Prabhupada was asked by one devotee named Jivananda, 1967, just a young guitar-playing fellow, who had the mercy of Prabhupada's association. So he asked Prabhupada, what's it like in Krishna Loka? So Prabhupada replied, you won't be bothered by the draft board. What's it like in Krishna Loka? What's it like in Krishna Loka? Where's our point of reference? Our points of reference are all matter. what's it like to be free from matter and still be there and experiencing, you know. So the impersonalists say it's like deep sleep, because it's the absence of all material experience. It's like it's deep sleep. So we take their example and pull something more from it. The more from it is, you remember your deep sleep? That means you existed at that time, even though you weren't aware of your own existence, you only existed. But you still existed even though you weren't aware of it. And the proof is, when you awake, you say, oh, that was so refreshing, I had such a good sleep. So it's I who had the sleep, even though you weren't aware of the I-ness of it. What's it like in Krishna Loka? It is said in Chaitanya Bhagavat by Kirtan, Mahaprabhu made the bliss of Vaikuntha descend. So sometimes by the grace of the holy name, sometimes by the grace of the Dham, by the grace of the deities, by the grace of the Bhagavatam, by the grace of a devotee, you know, we get a little bit of a glimpse of a fragrance that's not of this world, and we recognize it as not of this world, and we want it, our taste, our thirst, our hunger, our desire increases, but then it vanishes. And we thought it was us who had done it, because I was looking at the deities, because I was studying the Bhagavatam, because I was doing this, because I was, but it actually wasn't because of I, it was because of him or her or them or whatever. You know, it's just some grace. So those are our cherished jewels, because they keep our desire. Those gifts are the most wonderful things that we have. They're truly of value. And they're ours forever. And we could think on one level, oh, I'm so unfortunate because I lost it. But really, we're so fortunate that we got a smallest glimpses of it. Any other questions or comments? That was quite an introduction.
No, it's just that I was this comparing the state of Susupti with the Sayujya Mukti seems to me that there are some elements of comparison, but it's not the same.
Yes, yes.
It's not the same.
It's comparison.
Yeah, it's not the same. Because the state of Susupti is more, it's tinged by, it's a covered state of consciousness, in which, okay, we are experiencing freedom from the mind and the gross body.
You're talking about deep sleep now.
Susupti and deep sleep. We're experiencing freedom from the subtle and gross elements. But we are not, there is an experience, but that experience is covered by tamas, and we are not aware of what we are going through very much. We are not.
Are we going through anything?
Well, yeah, there we exist. The existence is there, but we are not fully aware of that existence.
We're not aware of our existence.
Yeah, just like when we sleep, we experience so many things, but the thing is, we don't know that it's a dream. We are not. It's covered.
But this, okay, but that's dreaming sleep. But this susupti is.
Yeah, but the common thing between the two is that, of course, in waking existence, most of the conditioned soul don't even know they are awake. At least those who have some spiritual consciousness have the understanding that now I'm awake. Then, but when we sleep, and during sleep, we don't know we are sleeping. We think the tiger is there, and we think this is there.
Right, and in deep sleep.
And in deep sleep, so there's no activity of the mind and senses and everything. But we also don't really realize what we are going through.
Are we going through anything? Is the question.
Yeah, it's more a sort of, as I had understood before, Susupti is more a state of non-being or something.
Or only being.
It's not the, the experience of Brahman, because in the experience of Brahman, there is full consciousness, just there's no identity, there's no sense of separatedness from others, there's no awareness of others, there's no awareness of personality, qualities or anything.
There's only awareness of?
Of the light of existence, such. But there is consciousness.
But it's not, but it's not awareness of that consciousness. There's no... of existence.
In Brahman Jyoti, there is existence.
Right, but there's no awareness of the existence.
Yeah.
Individual awareness of the existence.
Because the sense of the experience is there, whereas in Susukti, the experience is there, but it's covered. The consciousness is not awake in Susukti fully. There's a slight consciousness which is there, because consciousness can never be distinguished. But it's different from the
Brahma
Jyoti. All the Yoga Shastras and in the Bhagavatam, we hear about the fourth state. So liberation is the fourth state.
Yeah.
By definition, it's beyond.
Sushupti is third.
Yeah, Sushupti is third. And apparently, yogis can be in the fourth state while being in Sushupti. And as far as I remember, Baladev, Shibaldev in Vedanta Sutra says that you go into the Tamasa Shakti of Brahman during Sushupti. Into Brahma Jyoti, but into the Tamasa Shakti, so, which is different from Turiya, or the fourth state. And those who are beyond conditioning, they can be apparently conscious or aware even while being in deep sleep. Like we can see some of some example, like Purnachandra Maharaj recently, he was in coma. He was responding when devotees were, so coma would be like sushupti or something, isn't it? And then devotees were coming and asking or speaking to him, and he was responding somehow. He was responding to kirtan, he was responding. So it appears that he was in some kind of a consciousness, although as far as his subtle body is concerned, it wasn't functioning.
Gross body.
Gross body, and well, coma means what's coma? Coma is like sushupti.
Maybe he was experiencing an out of the body experience.
Yeah,
looking at himself.
At any rate, this is my attempt at an example. But but the shastra says that a liberated person or a person who is very advanced, they can be conscious even at the deep sleep. They still retain some kind of awareness. So there is definitely a difference between liberation and sleep, even for an impersonalist. But at the same time, there are comparisons even by impersonalists. There is one famous sutra in Patanjali Yoga Sutras where he says that sleep is one of the aids at realizing samadhi. So some, even impersonal commentators, they say that because, I think even Shankara is there, there are many different interesting commentaries, but even some of the more impersonal ones say that because liberation is like sleep.
Yeah, it's like sleep. What we could say is this, that third state, because what is impersonal liberation like? It's like that non-dreaming state. That's the analogy that's usually given. It's like that, but it's not that. That you're sleeping.
But it's still a notion of consciousness.
And that's where we take it. We take that point from it. It's like that, and just as you don't actually lose your identity, although you lose your experience of existing in deep sleep. Similarly, you're an eternal soul, and you don't. And even though you're in Sayuja, Brahma Sayuja, you don't have consciousness of your existence. Still, you don't ultimately lose your personal existence because you're eternal soul. So it's analogy, metaphorical. Is that That's what you were saying, basically. It's not exactly the same, right?
No, it's not exactly the same.
Yeah, so that was your point. Because, and also because in Brahma Sayuja, you know, there's also a way of looking at it that you can't get out. Because when the cowherd men, after Krishna came back from rescuing Nanda Maharaj from Varuna, and Nanda Maharaj was glorifying how Varuna had glorified his wonderful son Krishna, then the cowherd men thought that we've heard before that he's like equal to Narayan, but now we actually think he's Narayan, because even Varuna was glorifying him. Not only does he have qualities like Narayan, we think he's actually Narayan. So if he's Narayan, that means we can get what's going to happen to us. We're so intimately connected with Narayan, he's certainly going to bless us. So he's going, what's going to be our destination after we leave this world? So without them asking Krishna, they were thinking like that. And then Krishna, the first thing he did was take them and threw them, dip them into the Akuragat, Brahmarudra, and they experienced Sayuja. And then he took them out because they couldn't get out themselves. He took them out and gave them a different realization of Vaikuntha or Golok realization. These things are very hard to understand.
This is it. Everyone does. So how?
Well, sometimes one could say that it falls from the platform talking about vimukta maninas, means impure intelligence. So that means for the person who's in this world moving, that's one way to understand it. Who wants to become insayuja, he can't be. He's imagining himself as liberated. That's one way to look at it. But we don't talk about that question of how we got here, how did we fall, where did we come from, etc., etc. We accept the point of view that Dhruva Prabhupada expressed in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna knows. When it's time for us to know these things, we will, but otherwise it's, we can't penetrate these things just with our finite intelligence. We are very fortunate. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Vrindavan Dham ki jai.